I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The Arab news network Al Jazeera is airing excerpts today of an audio tape that purportedly has a top al-Qaeda official, Ayman al-Zawahiri, calling on Muslims to imitate the 9/11 attacks. He mentions as possible targets the United States, Britain, Australia, and, surprisingly enough, Norway. News of the tape coincides with this country's terror alert, raised now for the fourth time since September 11th to orange, meaning high alert. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge has urged governors and mayors to beef up the number of police on duty, and the FAA is expected to recommend flight restrictions, like no overflights of sporting events. To explore why the warning pallets changed again, we speak now to Thomas Sanderson. He's deputy director of the Transnational Threats Initiative with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Thomas Sanderson, welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanderson, three times before we've been at level orange, only to have the alert lowered a few weeks later. How concerned should people be about this particular orange alert?
I think this is fairly significant, though. I don't think it means that people have to change their daily lives so much. What it means, I think, is that just law enforcement, intelligence, and the government at large has to change their level of vigilance.
This is more than the usual chatter we hear about. We hear of intercepted emails, for example.
It's more than the usual, but it's also musings over different modes of attack or times of attack or motivations as exhorted by Ayman al-Zawahiri, as you mentioned earlier.
What do you make of that recording by al-Zawahiri?
Well, I think it's fairly credible. Of course, imitating the 9/11 style attacks, as he mentioned, would be very difficult. But what I think he means is that he wants Muslims, extremists, that is, to engage in these attacks and to continue what we've seen in Saudi Arabia and in Morocco.
Do you think the al-Zawahiri tape is authentic?
Well, I think that he is alive because I think bin Laden is alive and Zawahiri is his number two. He's also his physician. Bin Laden has kidney problems and Zawahiri travels with him. I do think it's valid, and if not, I think the threat remains anyways.
So the difference here, raising the alert to high alert, is the apparent specificity of the threat.
Yes, and it's more the credibility than the specificity, because when you get a specific threat, you're able to direct the threat level to particular cities or states. But what I think they have here is that enough people talking about it that they feel it's credible. Very, very rarely in the intelligence community do you actually get a specific threat, because if you name the place you're going, you're sending the police there.
So does that suggest that these alleged email intercepts that we hear about mentioning New York and Boston, you don't find necessarily credible?
It's very difficult to tell at this point, but to identify particular cities is not wise, because after all, the terrorists want to succeed, and to identify the exact location just doesn't make any sense. However, Boston and New York are obviously large cities, and you could still conduct an attack even when identifying the city you're going to, but it makes greater sense to not mention it if you're the terrorist.
Right. You know, it's a question, just to finish up, that comes up every time. Crying wolf, what's the danger of if this is diminished, if this level alert is diminished in a few days, of people saying next time it comes up, boy, you know, I'm not changing anything I do.
Absolutely. You're getting a threat level fatigue in people once you do this. You're desensitizing them to the warning and care that should follow with that. But you have to do it, especially if you do have some credible threats of attack and you do have an increase in intercepted electronic conversations.
You'd bet on a peaceful Memorial Day weekend, or don't you even want to go there?
Maybe peaceful in the United States, but not elsewhere. I think that there may be attacks on softer targets, but I'd put it at about 50-50. I hate to ride the fence on it, but it's so easy to go either way. The guard will be up on Memorial Day, so that means it's less likely that someone would attack out of fear that they would fail. But then again, the symbolism is very strong and would provide great propaganda value.
Thomas Sanderson, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thomas Sanderson is a terrorism expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
Christy Todd Whitman, former New Jersey governor who joined the Bush administration as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, resigned that post this morning. In a letter to President Bush, Whitman said she's leaving to spend time with her family. Seth Borstein writes about the environment for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He's on the line from Washington. Seth, how do you read this resignation?
Well, Robin, this is something that's been rumored about for almost 2.5 years since she started.
Political insiders are telling us that her resignation is a sign of her frustration rather than perhaps a White House house cleaning. We saw Ari Fleischer leave earlier this week, and that perhaps people who have wanted to leave the administration have been told leave now rather than during the election. But tell us, why would Christy Todd Whitman be frustrated?
Well, I don't know how frustrated she is. She doesn't have the power that previous EPA administrators have. She is not the number one environment official in this administration by a long shot. Much of the power comes out of an obscure office in the Office of Management Budget, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, John Graham. He actually wields more power in this administration than Christine Todd Whitman has.
Well, you mentioned that it had been rumored that she'd be leaving. There was a lot of hope when Christy Todd Whitman came to this post because she was seen to be a moderate and good, if you will, on environmental issues. What happened?
Well, she actually, if you looked at her record was mostly on conservation, land issues, not pollution issues, where enviros looked and said she's green. Well, she was green on grass and land. In terms of pollution and regulations and pro-business atmosphere in regulating the environment, she was along mainstream Republicans, mainstream conservative Republicans.
Tick off, if you will, some of the issues that came and went during her tenure.
Well, she started with a big mistake with arsenic when they tried to loosen a Clinton-era rule on arsenic in drinking water, and that just blew up in her face, and she had to, because the science supported the Clinton rule, and she ended up retracting her proposed
change. But was that Christy Todd Whitman, or was that President Bush?
I mean, that was actually a Whitman. From everything I've heard, that was a Whitman thing, and the administration sort of let her twist in the wind. And then soon thereafter, she said that the administration was still going to try to regulate carbon dioxide, which is a main cause of global warming, because the president had said so in the campaign. Well, it turns out the president doesn't believe in that anymore. And soon after she said that, she again had to reverse ground.
The White House also declared the Kyoto Protocol on global warming dead.
That wasn't a surprise. That was something the White House had said for a while.
All told, do you see this then as not as some would see a conflict between Whitman and the administration, or as a former Clinton EPA person said, it was a debate between Whitman and Cheney, the green side versus the dark side? You don't see it that way?
I see Whitman not as this green official that some of the enviros see. I see she disagreed with the administration, but she was more good soldier than staunch advocate. I mean, from what I understand, her disagreements were, well, I don't think you're right, but I'll agree with you, as opposed to the first Bush, President Bush, had Bill Riley, who would argue and sometimes win over the hardliners in the administration, and because of that was much beloved in the EPA.
Seth, what do you think is next? Who do you think might take the position?
The three leading candidates are the former governor of Michigan, John Engler, who has upset many environmental groups in Michigan, the Florida environmental chief, whose name's David Strews, who is the brother-in-law to Andy Card, who's the chief of staff for the president, and Josephine Cooper, who is the head auto lobbyist and a former top EPA official under Reagan. My guess is if I had to put money on any of them, I'd put money on Josephine Cooper right now.
Well, we are not betting people, but we'll check back in with you when the announcement's made. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seth Borstein, national environmental correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers.
The discovery of a cow infected with mad cow disease in Alberta, Canada, has sparked an immediate U.S. ban on the import of beef, cattle, and animal feed from Canada. So far, no other infected animals have been identified among the country's 3.5 million cattle, and there's no evidence that the disease has spread. But the discovery, naturally enough, is raising concern among agricultural officials in both countries who are keenly aware of how serious an outbreak of bovine spongiform encephalopathy can be. After the disease was diagnosed in England in 1986, 180,000 livestock contracted the deadly illness, which also caused 100 human deaths. Joining us to discuss the news is Chuck Lambert, a Deputy Undersecretary for the Department of Agriculture. Welcome.
Thank you.
Chuck, how serious is this discovery of this infected cow in Alberta, Canada?
From our viewpoint, it's an isolated incident. The USDA, Department of Agriculture, and the Canadian government are closely coordinating to gather additional information from this herd. USDA will have a team of experts in Canada coordinating with this effort. So we're taking it very seriously, but at this stage, it's an isolated incident.
How do we know that there might not be another cow that could have, unlike this cow, slipped somehow into the food chain?
It's very important to remember this cow was not in the food chain. She was marketed, identified as a suspect, and was set aside for testing. So that product did not enter the food chain.
Right, but couldn't another cow possibly have, now that we know that mad cow is in Canada?
The Department of Agriculture and the Canadian government routinely test cattle. Last year, we tested nearly 20,000 cattle that would be in the highest risk category here in the U.S. The Canadians have a similar program. And so there is routine ongoing testing.
You really seem to feel that Americans shouldn't worry about this.
That's our viewpoint here. We've witnessed the incident in the U.K. We've learned a lot, I think, from that case study. And we've had many hurdles or many safeguards in place in the U.S. and in Canada, and have taken extraordinary measures to assure that we do not see the European scenario replayed here, and we're confident that this will remain an isolated or very, very low incidence case in the North American continent.
How much Canadian beef do Americans eat, and do we always know when we're eating Canadian beef?
The product from Canada comes in, is labeled in the boxes, or cattle that come into the U.S. are in sealed trucks subject to inspection by U.S. inspectors. So there is identification of that product.
What you're telling me is that Canadian beef is marked as it comes into the United States. Is it also marked when one buys it in a grocery?
At this stage, it is not. It is, as I say, identified as it comes in, and as of yesterday, all imports have been stopped.
Finally, how long do you think the ban will last?
I think that's just open speculation at this stage until we do gain additional information. As I say, we have a team of experts from the Department of Agriculture that will be in Canada. As additional information becomes available, we will, modify the ban accordingly.
Chuck Lambert, thank you very much for speaking with Here and Now.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Chuck Lambert is a Deputy Undersecretary for the USDA.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brigham's Ice Cream, introducing the new Brigham's Ice Cream Bars made with Brigham's vanilla ice cream and covered with milk or dark chocolate, available at most supermarkets and at Brigham's restaurants, and by the Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm-fresh milk in glass bottles, now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods Market and on the web at crescentridge.com. In the forecast this afternoon, we have a chance of showers with high near 70. Cloudy tonight with a chance of showers up till midnight. Overnight lows around 50. And tomorrow all the way through Memorial Day weekend looks like it'll be cloudy with a chance of rain. Highs topping out at about 60 degrees. 69 right now at WBUR.
This is Bob Oakes. What do you get when you make a contribution to WBUR? Balanced coverage you can rely on, pride in supporting public radio, and maybe a new car. For a limited time, WBUR would like to say thank you for your contribution for the news by entering your name in a drawing to win a brand new 2003 Subaru Baja, courtesy Cityside Subaru of Arlington. See the Subaru Baja and enter the drawing today at our website, WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Art Spiegelman's Mouse, incredibly enough, tells the story of the Holocaust using cats and mice. Now, Iranian-born Marjan Satrapi also uses cartoon panels to tell the story of growing up in Iran during the revolution. The book also manages to tell the history of a country pummeled by external forces, from the Mongols to the modern-day Iraqis during the eight-year Iraq-Iran War, and by internal forces, imperialists, and homegrown revolutionary torturers. The book is called Persepolis, The Story of a Childhood, and Marjan joins us in the studio. And by the way, there are comic panels from the book on our website at here-now.org. Hello, Marjan.
Hello.
We are falling in love with this book.
Thank you very much.
It's delightful. Can you kind of tell us what it looks like? I've said it's a comic book, and it's you. You're the character as a child.
Yes, well, you know, that's the story starts at about the Iranian Revolution, and I'm between the age of, let's say, 5 and 10. Mm-hmm. And then the story continues as the war started between Iran and Iraq, and it goes until the age of 14 when I left my country for the first time to go to Austria.
And the little girl we meet in the beginning, you, is the daughter of educated intellectuals, the great-granddaughter of a former Persian emperor, she finds out. And early on in the story of little Margie, you are also a self-proclaimed prophet.
Oh, yes. I still think like that because, you know, I'm just going everywhere thinking that what I say is important enough that people would listen to me. So, you know, that is the sickness of all the lonely child. They think that they are at the center of the world, and probably that's my sickness too.
Well, come to think of it, that's right, because the little girl that you are, she wants to be the last prophet, but then
Yes. She
puts that aside for a while because she wants to be a revolutionary.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the format. It is, as we said, cartoon drawings. Really well done. I'm looking at page 11 where Margie takes us through the entire history of Persia or Iran. You studied art.
Oh, yes. Yes, that is what I always wanted to do. And, well, I didn't know that I would make, you know, comics or not. The fact was that I love to make illustration.
Did you know about Art Spiegelman as well and Mouse? Did that influence this story?
Oh, of course. I mean, that was in 1995 when for the first time I read Mouse. And I was so shocked. I was so, you know, that was really the thing that showed me that it was possible to make a very serious story out of this format, and that was probably the best way of doing it.
And to also include, if you will, the humor that a child saw in and during the revolution. Even in some of the most intense moments, you have such a great humor about it. Little Margie's waving her fist at her dad. She wants him to go fight. And she says, the Iraqis have always been our enemies. They want to invade us. And your dad says, and worse, they drive like maniacs.
Yes, you know, I mean, the Iranian, they have this big ability to laugh at themselves, you know. As soon as something happened, you have billions of jokes coming about this event, and that is our way of surviving. Otherwise, all of us, we would have been already dead.
Mm. Page 133, gosh, little Margie looks to be about 13 now, and she's tempting the culture police. She goes out with your parents, I guess, did they really go to Turkey to bring you back?
Yes, of course.
What did they bring you back?
Well, they brought me two posters, one from Iron Maiden and the other one was from King Wild. I had a jean jacket, I had a pair of Nikes, and I was so cool. I thought that I was just number one in the whole world. And that is also to show that, you know, if you are Iranian and you are adolescent, you are not different from other adolescents, you know. It's the same.
Well,
it's the same.
The difference is that the guardians of the revolution stop you in the street and quiz you about, you know, the sneakers you have on. I'll read the panel. As you say, their job was to put us back on the straight and narrow. And so one woman says to you, why are we wearing those punk shoes? And you say, what punk shoes? Those. But these are sneakers. Shut up. They're punk. You go on. They ask you about your Michael Jackson button. What do I see here? Michael Jackson, that symbol of decadence. And you say, no, it's Malcolm X, the leader of black Muslims in America. And at the bottom of the panel, there's a note. Back then, Michael Jackson was still black. So,
well, he was. In 1983, Michael Jackson was still black.
Well, you know, I was in reading it, I was thinking this might be something to give to, you know, my 13-year-old niece to really understand.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that any age, they can read that.
Except I get to page 51, where Margie draws for us and describes for us, you know, the torture. There are several drawings of how the friends of your parents and other people they knew were tortured in jail. Pretty descriptive drawings, and including one man being burned with an iron, and at the bottom of the panel, little Margie's looking at her mother's iron with a new startled look in her eyes. I never imagined that you could use that appliance for torture. So we're reminded on just about every other page that this is not an ordinary comic book.
Well, but that is not an ordinary life neither. I mean, that's but no life is ordinary. It's just, you know, you have this outside surface that is always very shiny, and that is what you see on surface is just sufficient in any country just to put your nose a little bit further, and you have problems everywhere, you know.
Do you see any parallels between what's happening now in Iraq and what you witnessed as a child in Iran?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, it's the same story. During the year that we were in war with Iraq, you know, nobody cared about that. You know, Iraq was sending chemical bombs on our head. Nobody talked about it. And at this time, you know, Iraq was very much helped by the Westerners. You know, his photo of Rumsfeld shaking the hand with Saddam, telling him he can use whatever he wants, you know, to destroy Iran. And that's where he used the chemical bomb. And a few years after, Saddam is the enemy, et cetera, et cetera. That was a day when Iran was the best friend of America. And now we are the axis of evil. Probably this axis of evil is me. And through this book, they will see also the real life of 99% of the population of my country.
One last question. I'm trying to think of how to describe Margie. She's sort of a Madeline with a veil, or Pippi Longstockings with a veil. Do you know these American characters,
yeah,
or French characters?
I'll let you choose.
I think Pippi Longstockings
is a good one. Yeah,
yeah,
it's okay.
Pretty good. Well, Marjan Satrapi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having invited me.
Pippi During War. Marjan Satrapi, author-illustrator of the book Persepolis, The Story of a Childhood. To view some of the panels from the book, check out our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, world events have changed attitudes about nuclear weapons. Are we entering a second nuclear age?
Also, one of Puerto Rico's most beloved performers and social activist, Danny Rivera, and how jail time inspired his music. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Pine Hills, featuring a wide range of single-family homes, townhomes, and custom homes in Plymouth and online at pinehills.com. By Myrick O'Connell, attorneys at law, servicing clients' business needs with unique client teams designed to gather perspective and develop innovative solutions on the web at myrickoconnell.com. And the Boston Bean Coffee Company, purveyors of fine coffee, equipment and service to the workplace, and exclusive distributor of Pete's Coffee and Teas. Information at 1-800-448-BREW. Come explore the countryside and cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria with Sylvia Poggioli. That's our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more information, call 800-909-9287. Later this hour in Here and Now, food gurus Scott Haas and Kathy Gunst talk about food essentials. This is WBUR.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
The admission of 8 former communist countries is a very powerful symbol of Europe's reunification. So the EU is going to need some very serious internal reform, and everybody agrees that's not going to be very easy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Don't miss a chance to meet the incomparable Sylvia Poggioli at an exclusive brunch I'll be hosting on Sunday, June 1st. Seating is limited. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an exploding refugee crisis in Liberia threatens to destabilize all of West Africa as pressure grows for the Liberian president to step down.
He's got now 2 rebel groups, one pushing from the north, one pushing from the east. On the other hand, you've got the United Nations having just renewed sanctions against Liberia. You also have a war crimes investigations of Charles Taylor.
And later in the program, our food gurus. They suggest creative ways to stock your pantry. Try coconut milk or capers.
That's the key to a pantry, is that there are enough interesting ingredients in there to stimulate something new.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Security has been increased at strategic sites around the country after the terror alert level was raised yesterday to high. There were also reports that terrorists could be targeting the East Coast. Still, President Bush traveled to New London, Connecticut today to deliver the commencement address at the Coast Guard Academy. The president says the country is counting on them more than ever to guard the nation's coastal waters from terrorists.
Terrorists who seek to harm our country now face your shield of freedom. Every citizen can be grateful that the Coast Guard stands watch for America.
This year's Coast Guard class is the first to graduate and become a part of the new Department of Homeland Security. New reports from Saudi Arabia indicate that at least three al-Qaeda members arrested this week were planning a hijacking. According to Saudi officials, the men were planning to seize a plane from the southwestern port city of Jeddah. The arrests were made during a security sweep following last week's suicide bombings. A top al-Qaeda official is criticizing Arab leaders for catering to the U.S. The comments are on a new audio tape being aired now by Al Jazeera. The network claims the tape features the voice of one of Osama bin Laden's top lieutenants, according to Associated Press correspondent Nadia Abu El-Majda.
The voice on the tape is very similar to the voice of Ayman Zawahiri, who is the Egyptian top lieutenant of Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda network.
The voice also calls on Muslims to follow the example of the 9/11 attacks. The World Health Organization has extended its travel advisory to all of Taiwan, where 35 new SARS cases were reported today. The UN Health Agency had previously included only the capital city of Taipei. The spread of the disease has begun to ease in China and Hong Kong, which each reported two deaths today. The global toll from SARS now stands at 667. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency is stepping down. Christine Whitman submitted her resignation, saying she's leaving to spend more time with her family. It's one of several recent resignations in the administration. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is off 25 points at 85.66. The Nasdaq is down 11 at 14.81. And the S&P is down 2 at 9.11. It's 33 minutes past the hour. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Post Club, personal introductions with online access and events for busy, discerning singles. Information on current membership opportunities available at 617-332-CLUB. By Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. And techfusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. In the forecast, increasingly cloudy this afternoon, a chance of showers with highs near 70, heading into a cloudy, cool stretch starting tomorrow. 69 right now. And in sports, the Boston Celtics coach Jim O'Brien has agreed to a contract extension. A formal announcement is scheduled for this afternoon. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In a striking departure from normal diplomacy, the head of the UN Refugee Agency has called for the president of Liberia to step down. The blunt comment came as renewed fighting pushed at least 10,000 Liberians across the border into neighboring Ivory Coast, adding to Liberia's 1.3 million people who are already displaced. Although West Africa has long been torn by violence, international intervention is bringing a measure of stability to Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone. But Liberia has never recovered from the brutal 7-year civil war that brought President Charles Taylor to power and, in 1995, an election victory. Many observers are now saying that Liberian violence could further destabilize an already delicate region. Samini Sengupta is West Africa correspondent for The New York Times. She's been to Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. She joins us today from Abidjan, Ivory Coast. Hello, Samini.
Hello. How are you?
Samini, you've been to Liberia recently. Paint a picture for us.
It's hard to say what kind of a place is Liberia because so much of it is beyond access. because it is so unsafe. Monrovia certainly bears the physical remnants of all these years of war. There are lots of hollowed out buildings. There are lots of pickup trucks with soldiers in the back. There are densely packed camps for internally displaced people on the outskirts of the capital. And by internally displaced, I mean people who have had to flee their villages and their hometowns because of the fighting.
Outline briefly for us, if you will, the current situation, the crisis in Liberia.
The crisis in Liberia has pretty much engulfed about 70% of the provinces in Liberia, which means that for humanitarian aid workers, it has become virtually impossible to deliver food or medical help or any other kind of aid to vast swaths of the country. And this is one of the reasons that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Ruud Lubbers, who was on a tour of the region last week, was very, very pointed in his calls to the Liberian government to swiftly agree to a ceasefire. The other concern, of course, is that because of the absolutely vicious and seemingly unending Liberian war, there are refugees scattered throughout this region. They're in Sierra Leone, they're in Guinea, they're in Ivory Coast, and there are also Liberian fighters who are also scattered across this region. And that has increasingly focused the problem of this region on Liberia.
Why is President Charles Taylor being singled out by Ruud Lubbers, among others, as the source of the problem? He did win an election, after all, in Liberia, and it seems like a new rebel group has been the direct cause of the most recent fighting in Liberia.
Yeah, Taylor is facing pressure, it seems, from all sides. On one hand, he's got now two rebel groups, one pushing from the north, one pushing from the east. On the other hand, you've got the United Nations having just renewed sanctions against Liberia, which prohibits Liberia from selling its diamonds, from buying arms, and from its senior government officials from traveling abroad. You also have a war crimes court in Sierra Leone that has made a lot of noise about its investigations of Charles Taylor, charging it with having aided the rebels who fought the civil war in Sierra Leone some years ago. So the Taylor regime is really facing a crunch time from all sides. And for its part, it says that, look, we are not the only ones to blame for this civil war. There are rebel groups that are supported by heads of state in neighboring countries, and we cannot be the only ones who are singled out for blame.
Liberia, of course, a country created by American slaves who had returned to Africa. Why does the United States seem so disengaged now from the place?
The United States certainly has a diplomatic presence in Liberia and has been very, very interested in supporting the Sierra Leone War Crimes Court, which, as I just explained, has some bearing on Liberia. But the United States, unlike Britain, unlike France, has not in recent years been altogether supportive of things like peacekeeping forces, the kinds of things that you've seen France do in Ivory Coast, its former colony, the kind of thing you see Britain do in Sierra Leone, its former colony. And I think there is a sense now that unless all of the world powers, the major world powers, focus on this region as a region rather than focus on each country with its own civil wars, unless you look at the region and tackle the problem regionally, there is not going to be peace in any of these countries for any period of time.
Do you think all the momentous events in other parts of the world, like Iraq, of course, in the Middle East, make it very unlikely that the United States will turn its focus to a place like Liberia anytime soon?
Well, it's certainly one of the issues, and that's why the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said he was in West Africa at this moment. He said repeatedly that it was time to shift the attention entirely from Iraq and pay attention to other crises, to other humanitarian crises in the world. West Africa is certainly a very important one, and the Congo in Central Africa is perhaps the most daunting crisis. So I think that Washington will have to face, along with the other European powers, what exactly it's going to do about these problems.
With such an emphasis put by Ruud Lubbers on President Charles Taylor, what do you think difference it would make if Charles Taylor stepped down, or are the problems much deeper than one man?
Well, I think that people who are on the ground and people who are familiar with this region tell me that if Charles Taylor were overrun by the rebel groups, if there was, in fact, a clash in the capital of Monrovia, there would be a bloodbath. It's also been pointed out that the rebel groups don't particularly have a stellar record of respecting civilians. So I think that the vacuum that would be created if Taylor were, in fact, to step down or be overrun would actually be of some concern, not least for ordinary Liberians.
This sounds like a hopeless situation.
I think Sierra Leone also seemed like a hopeless situation to a great many people just a few years ago. It was a ruthless conflict, even by the standards of recent ruthless conflicts on this continent. And it took 17,500 United Nations peacekeepers to disarm nearly 50,000 fighters on both sides, rebels and government militias. Sierra Leone is a country in peace. It's had elections, roads are being rebuilt, schools are being rebuilt, there's a lot of development money pouring in. So I think to a lot of people in the so-called international community, certainly to the United States, Sierra Leone stands as a bit of a model of what international intervention can do. Having said that, I think everybody is quite aware that unless you tackle the conflicts in this region, the investments that have been made in Sierra Leone will go to pot.
Samini Sengupta, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Samini Sengupta is the West Africa correspondent for The New York Times. She joined us from Abidjan, Ivory Coast.
You're listening to Here and Now. Three families of Somali refugees arrived in Tucson, Arizona today, the first of more than 12,000 persecuted Somali Bantus who will be resettled in cities like Atlanta, Salt Lake City, and Springfield, Massachusetts, over the next few years. Until a few months ago, the Bantus had never seen things like alarm clocks or toilets. They were given a crash course in American life before leaving East Africa, but many Americans have no idea what these refugees have been through either, and their learning curve lies ahead. Joining us on the line from Phoenix, Arizona, is Robin Dunn-Marco. She's regional director of the International Rescue Committee, which is coordinating some of the refugees. And Robin, tell us first, why Tucson?
Well, Tucson actually has a relatively low cost of living. Jobs are readily available in entry-level positions. The community is very open to resettlement of refugees, and we've had great experiences in the past.
Well, that's good, at least. But the Bantu people have a horrendous history. They were brought to Somalia from southern Africa as slaves in the 19th century. When slavery was banished, they were treated like second-class citizens and, in fact, raped and killed when the Somali Civil War broke out in 91. So they fled to Kenya, where they were put in refugee camps. You've worked in Somalia. You do know about their history. Do you think they're going to be able to adjust to Tucson?
Oh, absolutely. You know, refugees in general are very, very resilient. They will be very appreciative of the freedom and the opportunities that they're given here. They've never had this before. They will be like sponges, very eager to learn. Our job is basically to get them self-sufficient as quickly as possible.
I know you have had experience with this. You introduced some of the lost boys of Sudan to America, and there were some anecdotes from that.
Right. I went with them to a fast food place as kind of an introduction to fast food in America, which we don't typically do, by the way. But one of the things that was very striking is they didn't actually even know how to eat a sandwich. When they opened up the sandwich, they started, you know, picking it apart or, like, taking the top bun off. And
I do that.
They hadn't eaten a sandwich before.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, we've had people who tried to gather wood and put wood in their oven, thinking that, you know, the wood had to be in the oven to get the burners on. So nothing can be taken for granted.
Well, you said that Tucson is very open and has been in the past, but at least one city in the country has opposed plans to resettle Somali Bantus. That's Holyoke, Massachusetts. And up in Lewiston, Maine, they had their own problems with Somalis who then brought their relatives. And there were people who were just worrying that a refugee population might overwhelm the city. Have you heard that?
Not in Phoenix and Tucson. And I think refugees aren't coming here to improve their economic status. They're coming here because they need freedom, and the Bantu are no exception. The jobs that they typically start with are jobs that Americans aren't usually real interested in. Refugees will be applying for food stamps when they first come in, but again, our job is to help them become self-sufficient as quickly as possible.
Overall, are you, overall hopeful that this will work?
Oh, absolutely. You know, with the Lost Boys, we have one of our clients in Tucson who is graduating this week from Pima Community College with honors. And he worked full-time and went to school full-time. And we see people who had no chance at life, basically, have the freedoms and make it work here.
Well, Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Dunn-Marcos is Regional Director of the International Rescue Committee in Phoenix, Arizona.
It's Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by William Gallagher Associates, primary sponsor of Marketplace on WBUR, specializing in directors and officers insurance for publicly traded companies, WGAINS.com. The law firm of Sharon & Lodgen, LLP, over 50 years' experience in transactional practice, business litigation, and related areas of practice, SHERIN.com. And by Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events, 617-261-6060. Meet Here and Now host Bill Delaney and learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour of Ireland at a free reception that'll be on Tuesday, May 27th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. News from the BBC coming up at 1 o'clock. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
If you're listening to Here and Now at home, head on over to the pantry and take a look. It occurs to us many people don't even have a kitchen pantry anymore, and others wouldn't know what to do with it even if they did have one. A well-stocked pantry, whether it's a separate room off the kitchen or just a cabinet, is a lifesaver, which is why we've invited Here and Now's food guru Scott Haas and resident chef Kathy Gunst to bring in some must-have items on their pantry list. Hello to you both.
Hi, hey, Robin. There.
Start with you, Kathy. Boy, you don't live in my kitchen. I'm looking at some of these. This seems pretty exotic. What do you have there?
Well, they're not that exotic. What I wanted to start with is something that's what years ago was very exotic, coconut milk. I now found this in my regular supermarket up in southern Maine, so no longer can that be termed exotic if I find it at the Shop and Save in southern Maine.
And is it something you might grab? I mean, you made a beautiful soup for us once, but is it something you might just grab?
Absolutely. The whole idea of having a well-stocked pantry is that on those nights when you're completely burnt out and you've worked all day and you don't have another ounce of energy to get to the store, that you can make a meal using what you find in your pantry. And when I look at this table at the items Scott brought and the ones I have, you could make several fabulous meals from this. So the coconut milk, what would you do with that? You think, oh, you have to be an exotic Thai cook, you need to take classes. In fact, what all these items have in common is that they add a kind of exotic, interesting twist to everyday foods. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're heating up some chicken soup, homemade or chicken broth, and let's say you break a few noodles into them, regular old spaghetti or vermicelli noodles. Let's say you have a piece of ginger left over in your refrigerator. You could grate that into it. You add half a can of coconut milk, a little bit of lime, and you suddenly have a Thai coconut soup.
Mm.
Instant. Like, let's say you're sauteing a chicken breast. Instead of, the same old thing, like you just add a little paprika or garlic and that's it, you add some coconut milk. And again, if you have lemon or lime, just the coconut milk, it's very rich. You can use it almost like you use heavy cream, but it's a lot better for you than heavy cream. It is also purported to cure nausea and car sickness.
It's good for road trips?
You need coconut milk in the car at all times. But it really adds a kind of an instant exoticness to very normal everyday foods.
Well, I'll say. Now, Scott, I'm glancing over at yours, and some people might say, well, you got to have an extra mayo, a bottle of mayo, some cans of tuna. Most people would say a little olive oil, but that looks, is that fancy? What is that?
It's extra virgin olive oil. I'm not a connoisseur of olive oil. But one of the things that all these things have in common also is that they're all, relatively speaking, very healthy. What I try to have in my pantry is something that I can rely upon that's really flavorful that will enable me to avoid getting takeout. Takeout is delicious, but it's really high in fat, and that's why people buy it. It's convenient, and also it's kind of this rush. The great thing about olive oil, I went to this conference sponsored by a food group called Old Ways, and there was a doctor there who said patients at Christmas used to give him bottles of scotch, and he said, you know, I don't drink. Give me olive oil. So he now
I do
has.
Smart man.
I do
smart
that.
Man.
Every Christmas now he gets these bottles of olive oil, and he gets, 25 or 30 in his pantry. So this is just a terrific olive oil from southern Italy that if you have tomatoes in the house, if you have a really nice piece of cardboard, you can put the olive oil. Olive oil tastes good with anything, just bread.
Cardboard and olive oil.
What
Scott, I'm getting hungry.
Anything. Carrots, olive, tomatoes, bread. It's the kind of thing that really adds enormous flavor, and it's enormously healthy. I'm not only health conscious, but it's okay. It's not butter.
Plus, as you've said, if you find yourself rushing out to someone's birthday party, you can grab the bottle of olive oil and throw a wrap around it.
I just want to put a plug in that, in fact, you don't have to buy very expensive olive oil. I always keep an extra virgin olive oil for cooking. You have to go to a place that has lots of olive oil because you'll know it's fresh. And many bottles now will tell you when it expires. Mm. And then you have a really good bottle for those special salads and special meals.
It shouldn't be a snob appeal thing. I agree completely. It should just be something that's really tasty. And I don't think that the generic olive oil that's sold in supermarkets is as good as these bottled olive oils. But I think Kathy would agree that you can buy good bottled olive oils that are not like $1 zillion.
I always agree with you, Scott.
You're so sweet.
Yeah, right.
Kathy, tick through some other things on your list and tell us where they might pop
capers.
Up in a meal.
Capers. I just adore these. Capers are the flower bud of a bush that grows throughout the Mediterranean. And these small little buds are picked. They're dried in the sun. And they're then pickled in a brine solution. That's what these are. These are from Greece. They're very small and tart. Piquant, one of my favorite food words. I love it on fish if you're sauteing a piece of fillet, if you're grilling this summer to throw some capers over at the end. But I made you one of my absolute favorite dishes. Mm. This is so simple. This is a green caper sauce. And what it is chopped parsley or basil, scallions, olive oil. I've used almost all our ingredients here, and lots of capers. And I roasted asparagus. Mm. It's a fabulous combination with it. So try that. This is a great way to use capers. They add a lot of flavor. And you don't need an awful lot of them.
Okay. No. Scott, can I interrupt your asparagus?
He's munching.
What have you got over there? It's interesting that you both have almost completely different lineups here, but what have you got, Scott?
Well, we
fought over this. I wanted the olive oil. I wanted the pasta, but Scott got them.
But you know what's interesting? Except for the coconut milk, there's a lot of Mediterranean stuff floating around here. I brought in falafel. This is Israeli falafel, and the difference between perhaps Israeli falafel and falafel from, say, Lebanon or Jordan or Egypt is made from ground chickpeas. The falafel from other nations has to do with ground chickpeas and ground fava beans. So, in my opinion, these are have a crunchier, different taste.
Tell us
what this is.
What is it?
This is a can. It says in Hebrew falafel on it, and I bought this from an Armenian grocery store called Arax. But you can also buy all kinds of falafel, Lebanese, Israeli falafel, depending on your politics and flavors, what you're looking for at your local supermarket.
Let's explain, Scott. First of all, this is a can of the materials to make the falafel with. You just roll them up like a meatball?
You take the powdery mixture. You let it soak in, say, a half a cup of water, depending on how much you're using, of course. Let it soak for 7 or 8 minutes. Get the oil super hot. And then form them into little tiny meatballs, not little tiny, but the size of, say, golf balls, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Then put them in the oil, take them out, let them dry, and then you have them with some tahina sauce and on pita bread.
Oh, this is great.
How
You've got
great.
That there.
So it never goes bad.
It never goes bad.
It's an instant dinner, then.
Yeah, it's really healthy. Well, and I don't mean to be health conscious, but as I say, when I'm really tired and I get home from work, my inclination is to get takeout. I brought a takeout menu here just to demonstrate that it's true. But I really want to avoid takeout because it's expensive, it's high in fat, it's just it's bad.
That's the key to a pantry, is that there are enough interesting ingredients in there to stimulate something new. What I always tell people is every time you go to the grocery store, buy one new ingredient, just one. It could be a dollar. It could be $3. Maybe it's the can of coconut milk. Maybe it's capers. Maybe it's a good olive oil.
Or the falafel.
Or the falafel. What happens is that each time you go to cook, your cooking's going to change just a little bit based on one ingredient. It's almost like a magic thing what happens.
Well, the other thing is to make sure that you just have something on hand. And just for listeners out there who are, as you said, it sounds a little fearful to have coconut milk or falafel, but you both demonstrated. I mean, this could take seconds to make.
It's really, really easy. There's instructions on the can.
But I just want to have noted that I actually once took a tour, and you'd have to call it that because it was so well-stocked, of Julia Child's pantry.
Oh.
We were so shocked. I mean, we were thinking it was going to be this exotic. You know, this is the gourmet cook, and we thought she had deviled ham, canned deviled
right,
ham,
right.
Spread it on a Triscuit. And she always had on hand peanut butter
of course.
And honey. Mm. And the combination of those two also can make some.
What about tuna fish? We're forgetting that.
Tuna, that's
the, right.
Peanut butter and jelly.
Right.
These are standard things, but you don't just have to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Peanut butter could be used to make sesame noodles. Peanut butter could be used to make a satay sauce. Little twists in normal everyday cooking stimulates you and makes you want to cook.
And Julia also was a classic French chef, whereas it's also the year 2003, and we're more, it's a more eclectic, open world. There's more diversity in our pantries, reflecting the diversity in our communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have had falafel, let's say, or a lot of people wouldn't have had falafel or capers or...
Certainly not coconut milk.
Not coconut milks, but our communities have changed. You know?
Well, that's what's funny, because 20 years ago, we would have had deviled ham, and she still does. So God bless her. Well, thank you both for coming in and opening up your pantry for us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Here in House food guru Scott Haas and resident chef and cookbook author Kathy Gunst. For a list of their suggested items, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortlieb.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tom Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell and Marisa Francini.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR.